Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
From WBUR in Boston, it's Here and Now. I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young. Coming up, the head of the Independent Commission investigating the September 11th attacks says those attacks did not have to happen and names will be named.
There's new evidence about Washington's cozy relationship with Saddam Hussein when he was using weapons of mass destruction against Iran.
And drugs, dumpsters, and identity thieves.
Methamphetamine is like taking 100 cups of espresso. And so once they're on a high, they're more than happy to sit through and go through papers in a dumpster for 12, 24, 48 hours.
These stories and Robert McNamara on the fog of war coming up here and now.
The news is first.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Ann Bozell. U.S. Central Command says the guided missile destroyer USS Decatur intercepted a boat in the Persian Gulf on Monday. It says the boat was found in an area known to be a smuggling route for the al-Qaeda terrorist network. It was carrying 2 tons of hashish. The Navy says 4 of the 12 people on board are suspected of having ties to al-Qaeda. The U.S. administrator in Iraq, Paul Bremer, has confirmed that his convoy was attacked earlier this month near the Baghdad airport. The BBC's Demitha Luthra has more.
Paul Bremer was visiting the southern city of Basra to examine the progress that's been made. Whilst here, he was asked if there'd been an assassination attempt against him. He shrugged his shoulders and replied, "Yes, this is true, but thankfully I'm still alive and here I am in front of you." The incident happened on December the 6th. He was returning from Baghdad airport when his convoy ran into an explosive device and his own personal armored vehicle came under fire. No one was reported injured.
The BBC's Demitha Luthra in Basra. A federal appeals court has overturned a ruling that allowed the recording industry to subpoena internet service providers in their hunt for people who illegally download music. NPR's Netta Ulaby reports.
The ruling is a setback for the recording industry's controversial anti-piracy campaign. It overturns an earlier decision by a U.S. district judge that forced Verizon Communications to turn over 4 names and addresses of internet subscribers accused of music piracy. At the time, Verizon challenged the constitutionality of the subpoenas, but went on to identify dozens of its subscribers to music industry lawyers. The Recording Industry Association of America held Verizon responsible for pirated music files because they were downloaded through the company's network. The appeals court said today such an argument, quote, borders upon the silly. But the RIAA says it plans to continue filing suits, with or without the names. Netta Ulaby, NPR News.
New York officials have released images of the new Freedom Tower to be built at the site of the World Trade Center. The building rises into a spire and is 1,776 feet high. New York Governor George Pataki says it will be a memorial to those who died in the September 11th terrorist attacks.
We will build it in honor of the memories of the heroes we lost. We will build it as a tribute to the courage and the strength of New Yorkers. And we will build it to show the world that freedom will always triumph over terror, and that we will face the 21st century and beyond with tremendous confidence.
The estimated cost of the tower will be $1.5 billion. It will contain 70 stories of offices. Stocks are mixed at this hour. On Wall Street, the Dow Industrials are up 16 points to 10,265 in active trade. The Nasdaq's down 7 to 1948. The S&P is down 1. This is NPR News. In NPR's business update, a Brooklyn jury has determined that Brown and Williamson Tobacco Company should pay $350,000 to a woman whose husband died of lung cancer. It's the first time a jury in New York State has awarded damages against a tobacco company. The company is expected to file an appeal. The federal government is eliminating dozens of jobs at Federal Reserve banks around the country. NPR's Dave Mattingly has more.
Up to 300 jobs are being eliminated at Fed banks in New York, Massachusetts, Virginia, Missouri, and Texas. 60 of 130 jobs in Buffalo are being phased out. The move, says a spokesman for the Bureau of Public Debt, is being prompted by a shift in how savings bonds are bought and sold, from paperwork applications to electronic ones. One bank manager says with more Americans doing their business over the Internet, fewer people are needed to handle the work. It's expected to take several years for all of the jobs to be eliminated. Officials say eventually some positions might be added once the retail savings bonds business is internet-based. Dave Mattingly, NPR News, Washington.
Real Networks is suing Microsoft, accusing the software giant of illegally monopolizing the field of digital media. Real Networks says Microsoft violated antitrust laws by requiring Windows users to accept the Microsoft Media Player. Hershey's unveiling a new low-carb chocolate bar. It's called Hershey's 1-gram sugar carb bar, and it will be available early next year. The low-carb bar is made from sugar alcohol and fiber instead of traditional sweeteners. Hershey says it has 20% fewer calories than a regular Hershey's milk chocolate bar. I'm Ann Bozell, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, working to enhance public understanding of science and technology and to portray the lives of men and women engaged in scientific and technological pursuit.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
The chairman of the Federal Commission investigating the September 11th attacks says years of mistakes, not chance, left the country vulnerable to terrorists. Former New Jersey Governor Thomas Keene has been careful not to point fingers at specific people, but indicated that he will name names in the report, due May 27th, and that certain government people should have been fired after the attacks. Julian Borger covers Washington for the Guardian newspaper. Julian, welcome.
Hello.
Tell us a little more about Thomas Keene's remarks. They were made first on CBS television and then in what seemed like a clarification on Nightline.
That's right. I mean, he started off on CBS by saying, "I don't believe it had to happen," which sort of breaks a taboo of officialdom. The White House official line has been that it couldn't have been prevented. But outside that, there was in a way nothing remarkable about him saying that. There were obviously mistakes leads weren't followed up by the FBI and CIA, and he seemed to be talking about that. He was saying that there were people that if he were doing the job, presumably meaning the top jobs in the FBI or CIA, they would no longer be in those positions. People would get fired. And so he was also suggesting that in the final report, when it comes out in May, names will be named and recommendations will be made that they should be subject to disciplinary action just for failing to see the leads.
And in the Nightline interview, he seemed to clarify a little bit that he wasn't specifically targeting either the Bush or the Clinton administrations.
That's right, saying no evidence that anyone high up in either of those administrations did anything wrong. And that seemed to be in a reaction to the obvious storm that his first remarks created, because when this report comes out, it's going to be sat down in the middle of an election campaign, and it's going to be passed over by both parties to see signs of blame, either the previous sort of Clinton administration that would have a negative effect on the Democrats, or looking at whether President Bush and his administration failed to protect the country, which would obviously be dynamite in the middle of an election campaign.
Well, of course, and some of the candidates are already jumping on this issue, but a Republican member of the same commission has come forward, and he's saying, wait a second, we're not at any point where we can fix blame or responsibility on anybody. So there seems to be some dissension on the commission.
Yes, I mean, it was remarkably early for Keene to be making these remarks, because they're about to launch into a set of public hearings where they're going to be talking to people in the FBI, CIA, and possibly even Presidents Clinton and Bush. So it does seem to be early to making the remarks, but they have been on the job for the best part of a year, and they have finally cut a deal with the White House to get hold of a whole lot of documents that the White House had been protecting under executive privilege. And that deal has been made where a small committee of their commission can look at these documents. So maybe he's talking about what he's seen in the documents or what has already been out there in a congressional report, which details some of the leads that weren't followed up and some of the suspicions of FBI field agents that weren't followed up by the headquarters. And all that's already in the public domain, and he may just have been commenting about that. Mm. It really, the parameters have been set by the White House saying, oh, it couldn't have been prevented, which is a difficult position to defend.
Well, and in fact, Julian, just in the few seconds we have, we should say that the White House has issued a statement. They watched the CBS report. They heard the exact words that you quoted, Mr. Keene saying this was not something that had to happen. And their response is, there's nothing that we have seen that leads us to believe that September 11th could have been prevented. And they didn't hear anything like that in Mr. Keene's remarks. So as you said, this will have to be continue to be parsed. Julian, thank you.
Thank you.
Julian Borger covers Washington for London's Guardian newspaper. He spoke to us from Washington, D.C.
Documents newly released under the Freedom of Information Act place Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld in Baghdad in 1984, personally assuring Saddam Hussein that the dictator's use of chemical weapons in the Iran-Iraq War did not threaten U.S.-Iraqi ties. Rumsfeld was then President Reagan's special Middle East envoy. The documents were obtained by the nonprofit National Security Archive. We're joined from Washington now by Malcolm Byrne. He's deputy director of the National Security Archive. Welcome, Malcolm.
Pleasure.
Malcolm, tell us about the memo that the National Security Archive unearthed that tells us about this Donald Rumsfeld meeting with Saddam Hussein in 1984.
Well, this is a memo that describes what, in fact, was the second meeting that Rumsfeld had with Saddam, the first one being almost exactly 20 years ago today, in fact, 20 years ago tomorrow. Mm-hmm. The March 1984 meeting was a follow-up meeting that may have been actually hastily scheduled. The document that we have is a State Department prep memo, essentially. It's a cable to Rumsfeld giving him some talking points for Saddam, among them the crucial point that he should do what he can to make sure that a recent State Department warning or condemnation of Iraq's use of chemical weapons should not be considered a direct attack on Iraq and Iraq's policies, but part of a larger commitment that the U.S. had to counter the use of chemical weapons, whoever was involved.
Who wrote the memo?
This was a memo that is signed by Secretary of State George Shultz, but all cables pretty much from the State Department have the Secretary's name on them. So it was probably drafted by someone in the Near East division of the State Department.
So these were talking points. How do we know what then Special Envoy Donald Rumsfeld actually said to Saddam Hussein about the U.S. posture toward Saddam Hussein's use of weapons of mass destruction at that time?
Well, we don't know. It's a great question because we don't have the documents yet that talk about what happened at the meeting. With the December 1983 meeting, at least we have some reporting that came from Rumsfeld and other State Department officials describing what went on. But we don't have those materials yet for this meeting, and that's an important gap that we need to fill. We can surmise that he would have said what the Secretary of State urged him to say, but we don't know exactly how he would have put it, how much emphasis he would have put on that point, and so on.
Is the National Security Archive suggesting that what Donald Rumsfeld did was in any way wrong? After all, he was simply carrying out the wishes of his government as an envoy, as a diplomat.
Right. Well, I mean, first of all, we're not saying one way or the other. We're not trying to characterize what he did. What we're trying to do is make available the historical record so that the rest of the public can figure out for themselves what happened. But it's important to know at least as much of the facts as possible, whether or not what he did was a mistake, was an error in judgment or anything like that is a different question. And it's also a question that's easier to pose 20 years after the event than at the time.
Yeah, of course, we just went to war largely because of concern over Saddam Hussein's weapons of mass destruction. At that time, a different realpolitik at work. Now, finally, what more do you think, Malcolm, may be unearthed as the National Security Archive continues to work the Freedom of Information Act?
Well, I think there is a lot yet to be learned. I mean, we're finding in our efforts that trying once is not enough to get these materials. For instance, this one document that we've been talking about was actually released to us through a Freedom of Information Act request some time ago, but it was missing the crucial page that is now included on our website in this collection of materials. There is a lot still out there about the very sensitive negotiations that took place between the U.S. and Iraq, and there is a lot that remains to be discovered about how different officials within the U.S. government felt about these issues. Still a lot for us to know.
We've been joined from Washington by Malcolm Byrne. He's Deputy Director of the National Security Archive. For more on all this, please go to our website, here-now.org. Malcolm Byrne, thank you very much.
Thank you.
War criminals facing justice have been in the spotlight this month, with Saddam Hussein's capture and Slobodan Milosevic's ongoing trial. But what about two figures indicted by the World War Crimes Tribunal almost a decade ago? Radovan Karadzic and Ratko Mladic have allegedly been hiding in plain sight ever since then. Why haven't they been captured? Stephen Coates is a reporter for Agence France-Presse. He's been following the story from Belgrade. Stephen, remind us briefly of the crimes of these two men.
They've been charged with crimes against humanity, war crimes, and genocide for their roles in the Bosnian War from 1992 to 1995. The genocide charge, the major charge, relates to the massacre of more than 7,000 Muslim men and boys at the eastern Bosnian town of Srebrenica in 95.
And we understand that there have been regular sightings of each of them, one in disguise, we read, and the government seemed to know where they are, so why haven't they been caught?
There's a lack of political will, I believe, in Serbia, where Mladic is believed to be hiding, and in the Serbian entity of Bosnia, where Karadzic is believed to be hiding.
Is there perhaps also a hesitancy to capture them because of what we're witnessing with Milosevic, who has an incredible platform now at The Hague, a public platform, and is running for an office?
Well, exactly. I think in Serbia in particular, there's among the moderates who've taken over government here after Milosevic was ousted 3 years ago, there is a reluctance to really make a martyr out of either of these men. And I think there's a consensus among the democratic bloc here that the pressure that The Hague brings on Belgrade to arrest Mladic is really only fueling the popularity of the radical nationalists who are posing quite a threat in these elections that are just a week away.
How does the general population feel about the capture of these two men?
Generally, among Serbs in Serbia and Bosnia, there is no enthusiasm for their capture at all. There was a poll in a Serbian newspaper a couple of months ago which showed that 75% of respondents would not tell the police if they knew where Mladic was hiding, and more than 50% say that they would actually help him escape arrest. Mm.
What kind of other pressure or incentives, if you will, are there for the Bosnian and Serbian governments to find both of them?
Well, their arrest is a key element for these two countries on their path to the European Union, which is a long way away. That's a long term thing, but in the short term, Washington regularly reviews their cooperation, the War Crimes Tribunal at The Hague, before it releases aid to these governments, and I believe a review of about $100 million worth of aid just to Belgrade is coming up in the next few weeks, and Mladic is explicitly an issue in that process.
Stephen, I just want to ask you briefly in the few seconds we have left. This past week saw incredibly dramatic confrontations at The Hague between former Yugoslav President Milosevic and Wesley Clark. They directly confronted each other. How is that being received in the Balkans?
People are tired of this whole story here. There's not much interest in what goes on at The Hague. Basically, the people in the Balkans the people in Serbia did away with Milosevic 3 years ago. And when we compare him with, say, Saddam, their Saddam is now in The Hague, and that story's over. And most people just don't want to know about it.
Huh. Well, Stephen, thank you.
Thank you.
Stephen Coates, a reporter for Agence France-Presse. He spoke to us from Belgrade.
There's more coming up here and now.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Someone you don't know and who doesn't know you but is pretending to be you may be turning your world upside down as we speak, threatening your finances, your credit rating, your reputation, your future. Identity theft victimized more than 7 million Americans in 2002. It costs the economy $53 billion a year, and the criminals are incredibly difficult to catch. No more than 1 in 700 who commit identity fraud are caught. Some say the percentage is actually more like 1 in 1,000. Well, Stephen Mim is the Newcomen Postdoctoral Fellow at Harvard Business School. Stephen profiles two masters of identity fraud in this weekend's New York Times Magazine. He joins us now in the studio. And welcome, Stephen.
Thank you.
Stephen Massey, let's start with him. Sent to prison in 2000, released in 2002. Just briefly, where is he now?
We don't know.
Okay.
I was put in touch with Stephen Massey by the district attorney who originally prosecuted him, and at that point he was on supervised release, federal parole, and he cooperated with us and met with me a couple times. I flew out to Oregon and had dinner with him, and I stayed in touch with him, interviewed him a few more times, and then shortly before we were closing the piece, he disappeared. He is now currently somewhere.
On the lam.
On the lam.
Who is Stephen Massey? He's a very modern example of a con artist,
absolutely.
A master of identity fraud. Tell us about
absolutely.
Him.
You've hit it, the nail on the head. He is a con artist, a confidence man. He is something of a failed small business owner who, after some marriages went awry, drifted into drugs, petty crime, and eventually, to feed his habit, decided that he would try to find a more lucrative means of making a living.
How did he steal people's identities? How good was he at it?
He stole them essentially on a very low-tech fashion that eventually had a high-tech component. What he would do is he would go to dumpsters and other places where personal information had been tossed out. Personal information meaning names, social security numbers, dates of birth. And he would then take that information, go to online credit reporting sites and sites that provided credit cards, and pose as that person, obtain credit cards in their name, new ones, and have them sent to a new address, that is, a post office box he had rented for the occasion. The credit cards would come, and they would be in his name. The victim would not even know this had taken place, and he would then begin to rack up charges.
Can you still do that so easily, Stephen? Dive into a dumpster, it's even called dumpster diving, come up with a social security number, turn it around into a credit card? Is it as easy as it was when he was doing this in the late 90s?
The first part is definitely still just as easy. The actual scam of going online, a lot of the security that credit card sites have has been tightened. But from what I've heard from federal prosecutors, a new generation of identity thieves has more than figured out how to circumvent those precautions.
Now, who's his partner in crime, Carrie Melton? Tell us about her.
Carrie Melton, a very fascinating figure, extremely bright woman, also a former small business owner who drifted into drugs, methamphetamine, and ended up working with Stephen Massey and kind of handling the digital side of things. She was the computer whiz of the duo.
There's a level of squalor to it, though.
Absolutely.
And that has a lot to do with the methamphetamine connection. Talk to us about that.
It's interesting. I mean, the myth, I think, of identity thieves is that they're just lone hackers out there doing this to make money. And that's, to a certain extent, that has some truth. But the information gets collected by hordes of petty criminals, most of whom typically, at least on the West Coast, are drug addicts who do this to feed their habit.
It has to do particularly with the particular high of methamphetamine.
Absolutely. As a prosecutor once told me, he said, you're not going to see many heroin addicts passed down an alley doing identity theft. Meth addicts, on the other hand, methamphetamine is like taking 100 cups of espresso. And so once they're on a high, they're more than happy to sit through and go through papers in a dumpster for 12, 24, 48 hours and collect this information, categorize it, copy it down, and then use it.
How difficult is it to catch people who do this?
Extraordinarily difficult. If you think about it, let's say you're a victim of identity theft. The typical way that you'll find out about your victimization is when you apply for, say, a home loan and your credit report comes up and it turns out that 4 years ago, someone in your name bought 20 Rolex watches on a number of different credit cards. The difficulty in reconstituting that crime wave, given that these people move around, they're constantly in different states, they're constantly changing laptops, changing phone numbers, changing addresses, it's extraordinarily difficult.
There's been some legislation passed.
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell us very briefly what it is and how effective it's been?
The states and the federal government now have legislation that has criminalized identity theft on the federal level, which has imposed some restrictions on financial service companies to keep information a little bit under lock and key. But unfortunately, that legislation doesn't apply to universities, doesn't apply to small businesses, doesn't apply to your dentist, your doctor. All that information is not regulated and can be just dumped in a dumpster.
What should people do to protect themselves?
They should first close off the bottleneck with their own waste and refuse. And a crosscut shredder, something that shreds vertically and horizontally, is the first thing they should purchase. Mm. Great Christmas present, Hanukkah present. That's the beginning. The second is not to give out their Social Security numbers unless absolutely necessary. And then finally, to get very frequent credit checks and credit reports. And if you detect something, best place to go is the Federal Trade Commission, which is invested with a kind of central authority of handling these complaints, and they can tell you what to do.
Your story has, I don't know if you call it a happy ending. We've said already Stephen Massey is on the run. Carrie Melton is actually trying to turn her life around.
Absolutely, and she's done a remarkable job of that. She has stayed clean. She is currently getting a college degree in computer networking, using some of her skills in a more legitimate way, and shows all signs of doing quite well.
Stephen Mim, fascinating article, fascinating work. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Stephen Mim is the Newcomen Postdoctoral Fellow at Harvard Business School. His article, Dumpster Diving for Your Identity, appears in this weekend's New York Times Magazine.
Next week on Here and Now, how some are using their vacation time training for a week with a company in Israel to learn what to do in a terror attack.
And we speak to presidential candidate Howard Dean. That's next week.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Coming up, in the wake of Saddam's capture, is the U.S. doing a good job communicating its position to the Arab world? Is it okay that President Bush doesn't read newspapers? Depends on who you ask.
And in the new film, The Fog of War, former Defense Secretary Robert McNamara talks about Vietnam and the Cuban Missile Crisis.
I want to say, and this is very important, at the end, we lucked out. It was luck that prevented nuclear war.
These stories, coming up here and now. I'm Dolores Handy. A spokesman for Paul Bremer, the top U.S. civilian administrator in Iraq, says the attack on Bremer earlier this month appeared to be a random ambush, not a targeted assassination attempt on Bremer. Bremer had been traveling to an unscheduled meeting when his convoy was attacked near Baghdad's airport. He was not injured. There were more attacks on U.S. troops and those aligned with them in Iraq today. Two U.S. soldiers were wounded and at least two Iraqis killed when a roadside bomb went off near a military tanker truck outside Baghdad. Iraqi officials blame loyalists of captured former dictator Saddam Hussein, who are also believed responsible for an explosion at the office of a major Shiite Muslim party. The explosion killed an Iraqi woman and injured five other people. The U.S. Navy intercepted and seized a boat carrying 2 tons of hashish and linked to the al-Qaeda terror network. The boat was seized earlier this week in the Persian Gulf near the Straits of Hormuz. U.S. Central Command says the drugs have a street value of up to $10 million. 4 of the 12 people on board are suspected of having ties to al-Qaeda. The sentencing phase of the trial of the second man convicted in last year's Washington, D.C. area sniper shooting spree is underway. This morning, jurors in the trial of teenager Lee Boyd Malvo heard a dramatic 911 call made by the husband of the FBI analyst Malvo was convicted of killing. Prosecutors say the tape demonstrates the vileness of the crime, a necessary factor under Virginia law for the jury to impose the death sentence. Malvo was found guilty yesterday. John Allen Muhammad was convicted earlier, and a jury has recommended that he be sentenced to die for his crimes. The recording industry has been dealt a big setback in its effort to track down people who distribute pirated music online. A federal appeals court has rejected industry efforts to force internet providers to identify suspected abuses. The decision by the 3-judge panel from the U.S. District Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia overturns a lower court ruling that enforced a copyright subpoena issued to Verizon Communications. New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg calls today a wonderful day, not just for New York, but for America. Images of a new Freedom Tower at the World Trade Center have been unveiled. The design echoes the Statue of Liberty and even contains elements of the Brooklyn Bridge. The tower rises 1,776 feet. On Wall Street at midday, the stocks are mixed. The Dow is up 11 points.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
As 2003 lurches towards a close, the picture of the year most likely will be the one of a bearded and bedraggled Saddam Hussein, taken by an anonymous U.S. soldier shortly after Hussein's capture. Today's Wall Street Journal called the Saddam images real reality television, too straight to spin. But many in the Arab world thought the images were pure fiction, and 97% of callers to the Arab satellite channel Al Jazeera said they believed the images of Saddam, being given a doctor's examination, were intended to humiliate Arabs. Well, the U.S. government is reacting to what obviously is a problem with communication. More on that in a moment. But first, fact, fiction, and filtering the news, the topics we're putting before our editorial roundtable today. Joining us on the line are Dorothy Rabinowitz, columnist and editorial board member at The Wall Street Journal. Hello, Dorothy.
Hello.
And Bill Nemitz, columnist at the Portland Press Herald in Portland, Maine. Hi, Bill.
Hi, Robin.
Well, to you first, Dorothy. Did the news media do a good job covering the Saddam capture?
I mean, I think let's go back to your very strange introduction. A typical national public radio introduction, I might say. It is the responsibility and the problem of the United States government and communication that a bunch of fanatical, mad ideologues insist on the fantasies that they perpetrate in the Arab world, and this is our fault.
Well,
the very idea that you are posing this is our problem is quite remarkable.
Well, I'm not. In fact, the U.S. government is. They are starting a new $62 million U.S. satellite news service. They're calling it Al-Houri, to beam news directly to the Arab world, they say, to overcome, they think, the false perceptions that are being spread by satellites like Al Jazeera.
That's not the same as identifying it as our problem. But do go on. Bill.
Bill, your thoughts.
Well, I'm still remembering that there are people who don't believe we landed on the moon, you know,
right.
and they think that was all staged, too. So I think any time you have a dramatic event like this, you're going to have a certain fringe, be it in this country, be it anywhere in the world, who are going to look at that and very easily be able to imagine that this has somehow been fabricated, or even this is not dignified enough, this is not befitting someone who, in some people's minds, was once a head of state. I don't know. I looked at the news breaking when they said they had him, and the first thing I wanted to see, and the networks obliged me very quickly, was I want to see him, you know, show me him. And they showed me him under the conditions in which they had him. What are they going to do, dress him up in a tuxedo? You know.
Well, you know, and Dorothy, continuing with communication problems, why is it, do you think? I mean, maybe there's a more internal media problem here in this country. Why do over half of Americans recently polled believe that Saddam Hussein directed the attacks on September 11th? Recently polled.
Because I suppose that's in the air. I really don't know the answer to that question. Because he may have done so, I doubt it. But we don't know.
Well, wouldn't it, part of that could be the fact that in the days immediately following September 11th, there were certain members of the Bush administration who were very eager to tie this whole thing to Iraq. So, I mean,
well, it may well be. You know, there is a document out, and which may prove to be valid, showing that Mohammed Atta was indeed in Iraq, and conferring with Saddam Hussein. Not all of these things are conceivably fantasies of the Bush administration.
And we should note that Newsweek is one of the media outlets that has discredited that document. So it remains to be seen. Well, apparently, as explosive as the Saddam Hussein story was over the weekend, viewers were a little less interested in it by Tuesday night. The president's sit-down interview with Diane Sawyer was seen by 11 million people. But hotel heiress Paris Hilton's program pulled in nearly 12 million to that. I don't know what that reality show is, something about her going and living on a farm or something. But in that interview the president did with Diane Sawyer, he told her something very interesting about newspapers while we're on that topic. Let's listen.
I get my news from people who don't editorialize. They give me the actual news. And it makes it easier to digest on a daily basis the facts.
Dorothy, how do you feel about a president who doesn't pick up a newspaper?
I feel just fine, I have to tell you. Presidents, I have to tell you, have been saying this for years and years, and it's not just George Bush. And to all of them, I say, I am very well satisfied that they get exactly the information they need from advisors. They actually have digests. There is a morning digest that the president reads. If you are asking me, why is it that the president does not enlarge his mind by reading Maureen Dowd in the New York Times and other such authorities? I can only say perhaps the president has something better to do.
Bill?
Well, I think it's not so much where he gets his information in terms of, you know, does he sit down and read five newspapers a morning? Probably not. The question is, where does the information come from?
Yeah.
And I would wonder if he's getting all of his information from Condi Rice and Paul Wolfowitz and Don Rumsfeld and Dick Cheney, well, I think that you could argue that that's not as broad a view of the world as he might possibly be getting.
Well,
does that mean he has to subscribe to every paper in the country? No.
Well, in fact, the San Francisco Chronicle editorializes after that comment. May we humbly suggest, yes, we're editorializing here, that the information that was supplied to the president before the war with Iraq was less than perfect. Some critics have suggested in newspapers that the president was not well served by the flimsy intelligence he received about Iraq's weapons of mass destruction or ties to al-Qaeda. May we suggest that the filter of the White House staff could at times have its own biases. Isn't that a good point?
I think it is.
Well, I mean, you have certainly picked your own newspaper to quote. I can pick you five other newspapers that would have said that the president had exactly the advice. There was, I have to point out, and you could look this up, powerful consensus on the part of the CIA and the State Department for the longest time and to this day that there are weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. Now, it has now been so contrived that anyone who holds this view is considered to be an ideologue and a fanatic, merely because an aggregate, you know, a huge number of the press and you know, various quarters of the polity have decided that there are no weapons of mass destruction, as though they knew this for a fact.
On the other hand, Dorothy, it has been demonstrated that in the months and even years leading up to this, our intelligence capabilities in that part of the world were seriously wanting. And I think if you're relying on those as your primary source of information, in retrospect, I think it can be argued that we did not have the quality of information that we may have thought we had.
And in fact, how do we feel about the other comment that the president made to Diane Sawyer, that in fact it really doesn't matter whether, I'm paraphrasing, whether the weapons of mass destruction exist or there might have been a plan to produce them, which is a huge distinction.
Well, in this country, you know, we prosecute people generally for what they did and not as much for what they may or may not do in the future. So, I mean, I think that is a huge distinction if it comes down to providing primary justification for the action that we took.
Yeah. Well, I'm afraid we have run out of time, which is always a shame when we gather you two together. Well, I want to thank you both and wish you both a happy holidays.
Thanks very much.
You too, Robin.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bill Nemitz, columnist at the Portland Press Herald in Portland, Maine. Dorothy Rabinowitz, columnist and editorial board member at the Wall Street Journal.
Well, still to come, it wasn't the fog of war that obscured the vision of U.S. leaders during Vietnam, as we'll hear from Robert McNamara, who doesn't want another generation to repeat his mistakes.
You're listening to Here and Now. This time of year, we tend to think of those time-honored holiday icons, reindeer, wreaths, a menorah, a mob of 100 Speedo-clad Santas barreling down the street. Well, okay, maybe this isn't your idea of typical holiday cheer, but for a bunch of scantily clad men and some women from the Boston area, it is. And they do it to raise money for AIDS research, over $14,000 this year. The group warmed up beforehand at the Daisy Buchanan Bar in Boston. Here and Now producer Lindsay Crudell was there.
My name is John Ainelli. I'm a co-coordinator of the Santa Speedo Run.
So how do you motivate about 100 guys to put on Speedos and run down one of Boston's fanciest, most upscale streets?
It started about 4 years ago. There was a bunch of guys that I hang out with. And one night somebody said, one of the guys was like, we should do something crazy this Christmas season, you know. And out came the idea of running down Newbury Street on a busy Saturday before Christmas, wearing Speedos and, you know, singing Christmas carols. So the first year it was five of us. You know, we didn't do it for a charity. It was just sort of a, you know, something crazy to do. And then we got so much attention when we did it, we figured we could do it for a good cause. And so we turned it into a charity event.
My name's Gary Austin.
So I understand that you're only allowed to wear either red or green Speedos to be festive. So are you red or green?
I have my green.
That's green.
Where could you be going when the wind is blowing and it's cold outside?
Woo!
Maybe it's chill.
Cold outside.
You guys just got outside. How do you feel?
Freezing.
Right now, well, we're really cold, but
it's a great time.
You know, such a great time.
It's coming.
Excuse me. Hi, did you see that?
Oh, yeah, I saw that.
What did you think?
It was pretty awful.
I thought it was fantastic.
You can hear them. They're coming.
They're coming.
Hey, who are you guys looking for?
All the friends that we have doing this.
People in Speedo. You want to see this. You definitely want to see this. You definitely want to see this. Yes. Here they come. Don't move. Don't move. Don't move. You're all set.
Three, four, five, six, seven.
I feel great. It was exhilarating. It was a good time. We're moving this together. Every late we stopped, sang some Christmas carols. It was good. It was fun for everyone.
Gonna go warm up now?
Yeah, I'm feeling warm already. I'm actually hotter than when I left.
That's interesting.
Job when you're in town. Later on, we'll conspire as we dream by the fire to face unafraid the plans that we made. Walking in a winter
Our visit to the 4th annual Santa Speedo Run was produced by Lindsay Crudell.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
The United States is haunted still by the war in Vietnam, a war now recognized virtually universally as a tragic mistake. But as much as a shadow as Vietnam still casts on the whole country, it also darkens individual lives and consciences of the still surviving men who were architects of the war and who led more than 50,000 Americans to their deaths. One of those men is former Defense Secretary Robert McNamara, who is examined with perhaps unprecedented intensity in a new documentary by renowned documentary filmmaker Errol Morris. The film's called The Fog of War.
We saw Vietnam as an element of the Cold War, not what they saw it as, a civil war. We were wrong.
We're joined now by Here and Now film reviewer Eric Schaefer to talk about Errol Morris's new film. Welcome, Eric.
Thank you, Bill.
McNamara apologized, Eric, as you know, in the mid-90s in a book he wrote and pieces he published for his decisions about Vietnam. Mm-hmm. This film is largely an interview with McNamara, right? Is it also an apologia?
This film is difficult to classify, like so many of Errol Morris's movies. The subtitle of the movie is 11 Lessons from the Life of Robert S. McNamara, and that's the way it's structured. We get these little title cards that come up at various points in the film that offer up these lessons, such as empathize with your enemy, and rationality will not save us. And then McNamara, addressing the camera directly, Morris's little Interatron camera system.
Right, that system that he has.
Yeah, basically expounds on these different lessons from his life.
So remind us what that system is, just briefly.
Well, it's sort of a contraption. I think it looks almost like a sort of like one of those little photo booths that you see in at sideshows and fairs,
right,
and so on. And Morris sits inside this thing and directs questions to the interviewee, who sort of responds back to this kind of...
Errol Morris is, in effect, not in the same space as the person he's interviewing.
Exactly.
And how does it work?
It works extremely well. This is a film in which we see a man really struggling with his place in history. And it's interesting. We do get a different sort of take on McNamara, particularly through the use of some of the audio clips. We hear a lot of the discussions between McNamara and Lyndon Johnson with that White House tape recording system. And it's interesting because, you know, he's coming off as someone who is a good good deal less gung-ho. He, you know, is in some instances advocating disengagement, getting out of Vietnam, but he's faced with a president who is worried about his own image, about looking weak to the rest of the world if we pull out of Vietnam, but he's also worried about the lives of Americans who will be lost. And, you know, these were men who were really between a rock and a hard place during that Cold War era.
A man with so many ghosts, Robert McNamara, I didn't realize that he was also an architect of the firebombing of Japanese cities in World War II.
Yeah. He worked under General Curtis LeMay during that time, and that provides one of the movie's most haunting images, where we see these bomb bay doors open from a bomber, and instead of seeing the bombs falling out, what we see are figures and calculations falling down, drifting down to the ground.
LeMay spoke in monosyllables. He stood up. Why are we here? You lost your wingman. It hurts me as much as it does you. I sent him there. And I've been there. I know what it is. But you lost one wingman, and we destroyed Tokyo.
A great movie? A good movie? What's your verdict?
I'd say it's a great movie. I think it's an important film, and it's a very relevant film, particularly for today in this post-9/11 climate and the Bush doctrine of preemption. McNamara is really addressing a lot of these issues, perhaps not consciously, but he's in a conversation with our present situation as well as with the past.
Here and Now film reviewer Eric Schaefer. Thanks, Eric.
You're very welcome, Bill.
Well, if Robert McNamara didn't speak about his reservations about Vietnam for years, now he feels compelled to.
My message today is, for God's sakes, don't duplicate in this century what we did in the last century. We humans kill 160 million other human beings through conflict, conflict within nations, across borders.
Here and Now attended a recent forum at the John F. Kennedy Library in Boston with McNamara, filmmaker Errol Morris, and moderator New York Times columnist Frank Rich. McNamara did most of the talking, as heard in these excerpts.
One thing that I think everyone in this audience must feel watching this movie is how applicable most of these lessons are to what's going on in Iraq.
Exactly.
And the same thing is true in your book, written obviously well before we knew about this war.
That's exactly right.
So apply them to Iraq.
Well, I'm not going to apply them. You all can apply them. I think it would be irresponsible for an ex-Secretary of Defense, when Americans are being killed and when the president is involved in very, very delicate negotiations with the UN and other international agencies and with allies, irresponsible for an ex-Secretary of Defense to comment, particularly if it were critical.
But still, I still don't see how that's applicable to why you didn't speak out after leaving office about the war.
Well, you're speaking now about Vietnam.
Right.
Yeah, I left office. There were still Americans in Vietnam fighting and being killed. And an American elected by the American people, Nixon, was dealing with that. I thought it would be wrong. I still think it would be wrong.
What would you say to the argument that you might have saved some of those lives if you had spoken out?
You present the evidence, I'll present the contrary. What I could have done, what I feared I'd do, is cause more killed. It would lead to more dissent, and it would give aid and comfort to the enemy. If the Secretary of Defense, or an ex-secretary, 1 week out of office, said to the North Vietnamese, we're losing the war, you can win if you keep at it. My God.
I noticed in interviews or little pieces about you during the 1980s, you were adamant about not giving interviews, not wanting to say your piece, and obviously you've changed your mind, culminating in this wonderful movie. Why did you decide to make yourself more fully known?
Well, I think that for two reasons. Number one, it took me about 10 years. Say I left the government in 67. It took until, well, even more than 10 years, but it certainly took at least 10 years for me to begin to see Vietnam in perspective. Mm-hmm. I believed in the domino theory. Kennedy did. Now, why do I think Kennedy would have not put 400,000 or 500,000 men there if he believed in the domino? The domino theory was if you lose South Vietnam, you lose East and South Asia. And you weaken American security across the world. He believed that. I know that. I think because if he believed that,
and we were losing in South Vietnam, then he would have to ask the question that was never debated. Could we prevent the loss by introducing large numbers of Americans? There was no full and proper debate of that. And I say that, in retrospect, that I believe Kennedy believed in the domino theory, but I think when he was faced with the necessity of putting in large numbers of U.S. troops, he would have forced a debate on that issue. And we didn't. And that was a terrible, terrible error. And it goes back to my basic point. Leaders hesitate to surface issues that will split their organization wide open. That's why we didn't discuss either of those things, domino theory or could we win the war by introducing Americans. Because at the highest level, the government would split apart. And I can draw analogies. You draw the analogies. I'm not going to mention them.
One of the exchanges that I did not put in the film, I asked Mr. McNamara at one point, is one of the lessons of Vietnam that we shouldn't interfere with the affairs of foreign countries, and he said no. He said one of the lessons of Vietnam is some conflicts have no military solution.
That's right.
And I think it, too, is a very,
Absolutely.
Very powerful lesson.
Yeah. And for me, I want to tell you, it took a lot of thinking to get to that point. I spent my life solving problems, and I believed until that point every problem had a solution. I'm prepared to say that today some problems don't have a solution, not an immediate solution, and many problems don't have military solutions.
Former Defense Secretary Robert McNamara, Frank Rich of the New York Times, and filmmaker Errol Morris recorded at a forum at the Kennedy Library speaking about the new film, The Fog of War.
Here and Now is a production of WVUR Boston.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
Get into your radio.
And join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
Join us next time for the news and these stories, Here and Now.
We'll see how some are using their vacation time to travel to Israel, where a company aims to teach people how to prepare for terrorist attacks.
And we speak to presidential candidate Howard Dean.
That's Public Radio's Midday News Magazine, Here and Now.